Chapter 4. The Giant. He groaned and tried to open his eyes. Where was he? Where in the world was he? The wine. Oh, yes, the wine. Way, way too much wine. He groaned again. His head felt as if an axe had been embedded in it, and his mouth tasted like a herd of Midian camels had made their trek through it. He smacked his dry lips and tried to roll over, but the effort sickened him. The massive man lay still for several minutes before finally forcing himself to roll from his stomach to his back. There, he continued to lie for a long while with his eyes closed. Eventually, he began to stretch in an attempt to bring a semblance of life into his limbs. He slowly raised his right arm and placed it on the top of his matted hair and began to bend his body completely to his left in the shape of the goddess of the moon when she reveals but a slight smile. He then did the same with his left arm and bent to the right. While he stretched in this direction, he ran his tongue across his teeth, but his mouth was so dry that it was difficult. It really did taste foul, and he was thirsty to the point of being parched. He straightened his body, but kept an arm over his eyes in an effort to stop the ache behind them, as well as to blot out what little light had entered the tent. I wonder the time, he thought, then groaned for the third time when he remembered that he must somehow get up, work himself into his armor, and challenge the cowards yet once again. Of course, he said to himself, I don't suppose I really need any armor. I could crawl out there in my nakedness, issue my challenge while on all fours, crawl back to my tent, go back to sleep, and there'd still be no takers. At least not from that lot, anyway. He started to chuckle at the picture in his mind, but all the action brought was yet deeper pain into his already miserable head. So again, he lay very still until presently he began to doze off. He caught himself, and as best he could, croaked out the name. Razed. He received no response, so he repeated the call with a little more muster. Razed. The feeble effort caused his head to throb, so he squeezed his eyes tightly shut and muttered, Cursed dog, where is that wretched excuse for a servant? This time he tried to yell, Razed! It came out as a hoarse screech, but it had apparently done the trick. The tent flap flew open, and a young man in his late teens ran in. Yes, master, yes, what is it? What can I do for you?
First thing you can do is come when I call. Where were you, you slothful swine? The giant said without looking up.
I've been standing outside the tent, my master. I didn't want to disturb you, and I've been keeping others from disturbing you, sir.
With his arm still resting over his eyes, he said, What time of the day is it? How long before I issue the challenge?
Sir, in truth, if we were to keep to the schedule, you should have done it an hour ago, sir.
The giant groaned again and told the servant to go get him some water and be quick about it. The young man took a glance at the water pitcher and saw that it had been spilled in the night. Probably when the drunken oaf finally stumbled into bed, the boy thought, but would never say it aloud in a thousand lifetimes. He grabbed the pitcher and made a dash for the water barrels, praying all the while that there was enough water in them to quench his master's thirst. Thankfully, the barrels had just been filled and brought into the camp. The boy cut through the line that was gathering in order to expedite the quenching of his master's thirst, but he received a harsh kick in the back for his effort. The soldier who had kicked him was about to do it again when a fellow Philistine stopped him with, That's Goliath's servant, you fool! The man quickly placed his raised foot back on the ground but proceeded to curse the youth anyway. The boy had no time for the man's threats nor his own reprisals, for he knew he had worse problems than an out-of-sorts impatient soldier. Back at the unusually large tent, he had an out-of-sorts giant with a terrible hangover. While never easy to please, in this state, Goliath was intractable and dangerous. Razed was 19 years old, possessed a tall, strong, angular body, and wore his raven-black hair to his shoulders. He was the third servant that Goliath had owned in the last year, and only the gods knew how many he'd had in the previous years. The first of this last three had been killed by a backhanded slap from the giant that had broken his neck. Though his death was technically an accident, the second servant, after 2 months' service, had run away into the night, no doubt fearing the same type of mishap. It was said that he was going to try to make it back to Egypt from whence he had been captured. He'll die in the wilderness if he tries that, one of the soldiers laughingly stated. Sadly, All who knew that vast, great wilderness knew that this was true. Roz had figured that his life was perhaps slightly more sacred than were those last two slaves, for neither one of them had been Philistines. The first had been a Hittite, and the last was an Egyptian. Having been born in Gath, Goliath's hometown, Roz had held a slight edge over a foreigner. At least his death might be questioned, that is, if anyone in authority had the courage to question the giant about anything. Another consideration in his favor, which the giant had learned the hard way, was that servants were not inexpensive. Unless you captured and trained one yourself, one could expect to put out a goodly amount of money for one, especially if they had any quality about them. Razad knew that he was a quality servant, in spite of his master's epithets to the contrary. Goliath knew it as well, or he would have never had the boy double as his armor-bearer. In any case, Goliath tended to enjoy the good life of a celebrity much too thoroughly to go about capturing and training servants for himself, and this last year had proven an expensive one when it came to servants. Still, with this oversized beast of a man, you just never knew. A little too much wine, an ache here or a pain there, and your life could be forfeited. Even if you were not maimed or killed, just having the man scream at you was an experience that the heart could ill afford to endure too often. Rosett had lost at least 20 pounds since becoming Goliath's servant, and it wasn't like he had the weight to spare. So he did his best and ran with a jug of water as fast as possible to the hungover, thirsty giant. The men who saw him running understood his plight completely, and most stepped clear of his way, if not out of sympathy, then at least out of fear. Not fear of Razed, but of the source of Razed's fear. He stopped abruptly at the tent flap, cleared his throat, and said quietly, "Master, it's me, Razed. I have your water." The grunt he heard was response enough. The boy lifted the flap and entered into the tent, filled with a soured smell of the drunken, polluted giant. The champion of the Philistines. The young man in the wagon had hoped to arrive much sooner, and knew he had no doubt missed the morning sacrifice. That was a sight he dearly had wanted to see, but it had taken much longer to procure a shepherd for his father's flock than he had imagined. Since the beginning of this latest campaign, when the king had sent him home, he was once again watching his father's flocks. The young man his father had hired to take his place when Saul's servants had called for him to come play music for the king was now with other employers, while other men and boys who might have been able to help had been conscripted into Saul's ever-growing army. At times like this, David sorely missed his old friend Reuel, the Benjamite. He had been a wonderful friend and mentor, and though he'd grown quite frail before his passing, he had never failed to give the young man excellent advice. Advice even as to which of the young men had potential as shepherds, who didn't, and what innate qualities he needed to look for. Now that he was gone, David found himself repeating the maxims over and over, such as, "Son, anyone can watch sheep for a few days, but to do it on a day-in, day-out basis over the years takes a very special, very patient man." David used this bit of wisdom to finally convince his father to go ahead and use his nephew Asahel. It was, after all, David kept repeating, only a couple of days until he would return from taking the food supplies to his three oldest brothers, who were now in Saul's army. "Surely, father, he'll be okay for that long," David said convincingly. Asahel was at first honored to watch the sheep, and he seriously prayed for a lion or bear to please come, that he might destroy it, even as his uncle David had done. However, when he heard that David was going to Shuco, the site of the Israeli and Philistine battle, he was beside himself with agony and begged to be able to go with David. He pleaded with his mother, Zeruiah, to let his brother Abishai watch the flocks, and before it was over, he was offering substantial bribes to both Abishai and his oldest brother, Joab. "Please, please, watch the sheep. I'll do all your chores for a week. No, for a month." Joab and Abishai both ended up having to cuff him about the ears to shut him up, while his mother threatened him with a beating if he didn't. Sullenly and sadly, the broken-hearted boy plopped down in the midst of the flock, and woe to the lion or bear that dared show its face. David, at last, was able to leave and was overwhelmed with eagerness as the wagon bounced and jostled toward Shuco. Though it was a good half-day journey from his home, it seemed an eternity. "Had I been able to leave yesterday afternoon, I could have already been there," he fumed as he remembered his dealings with the pouting, recalcitrant Asahel. Though the wagon driver was doing his best and pushed the mules as fast as possible through the rugged terrain, the young man's frustration emanated from his every pore. "You'll be fine. It's going to be okay," said Bakhtar, the old servant who guided the cart. If we get there in God's time, it'll be all right. While David knew this was true, he chafed nonetheless. It's not far now, Bakhtar added. It's going to be okay. You'll see. We probably won't make it in time for the sacrifice, but it'll be okay. You can see it this afternoon. When they at last came over the rise and saw the armies of Israel camped below them, David's heart leapt within him. He could see where they had offered the morning sacrifice off in the distance, and what looked to be a few Levites standing around it. He jumped from the moving wagon, ran ahead into a cadre of troops, and began looking for his brothers as he made his way toward the site of the offering. Though most of the men did not know him, they were familiar with his brothers and were relieved to see a new face. Having been parked on the same hill for 40 days, they found the young man's exuberant countenance refreshing. When they beheld the largesse in the back of the wagon, they were cheered further and hoped to somehow receive at least a part of it. Shammah was found, and he ran to David, eagerly giving him the heartiest of hugs and slaps on the back. Presently, Abinadab arrived, and after their greeting, followed David back to the wagon where Bakhtar had slipped over the seat and prepared to distribute the loaves of bread and roasted grain. They had not yet found Eliab, so his portion was to be set aside while David asked someone if they could go and find the captain of the unit, as 5 of the bundles of cheese were for him. It was at that moment they heard a thunderous voice coming from across the valley. David did not know what was happening, but he noticed the look of fear in his brother's eyes and the color draining from the men's faces. Shammah dropped some of the loaves and started to run, as had most of all the men who had gathered around the wagon. He looked back across the valley toward the source of the noise and was amazed to see the colossal form of a man, at least 9 feet tall and as wide across as 3 large men. He wore a bronze helmet and a bronze coat of armor that looked to weigh at least 200 pounds. His leggings were also of bronze, and he had a bronze javelin slung across his back as well. His spear shaft looked like a weaver's beam, and its iron point probably weighed 15 pounds. There was a young man bearing his shield ahead of him down the slope about 10 yards. David stood amazed at everything his eyes were beholding, both from Israel's army and the Philistine's giant. From over his shoulder, Razad heard the giant's cry, "Do we need whole armies to settle this? I will stand for the Philistines, and you choose someone to stand for you, and it will be settled in single combat. If your man is able to kill me, then the Philistines will be your slaves. But if I kill him, then Israel must be our slaves. I defy the armies of Israel this day. Send me a man who will fight. Send me a man." This was the 79th time that Razad had heard the speech, with only a few variations. The variations, when they came, were mainly in the form of even more foul curses, as well as mocking the Israelites and their pathetic army. At first, it had been an exciting thing to watch the Israelites run in fear, but that had grown old after the first week. "I wish someone would take him up on the challenge just so we could get this over with," he thought to himself yet one more time. "This is really pretty tiresome." Getting the giant dressed that morning had been a particularly odious task. He had reeked of soured wine and had such a body odor that it almost sent him reeling. Thankfully, he hadn't had to prepare something for the giant to eat, as the very thought of food had almost sent the behemoth to the edge of the camp to vomit. Not that he would have actually gone to the edge. The giant pretty much did what he wanted, where he wanted, and who was there to tell him differently? He was the Philistine's single most valuable weapon. Since this strategy of challenging Israel to send a single man to war, Goliath wielded more power than ever with his Philistine cohorts. Everything was set to rise and fall with him. All of Philistia knew that Israel had no one who could defeat him, and, as had been amply proved over the past month, no one was about to try. And even if they sent someone who somehow managed to overthrow the giant, the Philistines would never submit to these cowards and their strange Yahweh God. "Can you imagine only having one god to serve?" Razad thought. "How strange. How very strange." Still, he had heard rumors about their god. It was whispered that years ago the Israeli god had pretty well beat up Dagon. It was told that he had actually knocked him on his face one night, and that the next night he dismembered Dagon almost as thoroughly as the old man Samuel had chopped up Agag the Amalekite. While he knew the story was true about Samuel and Agag, he knew it just could not be true about Yahweh and Dagon. After all, the elders of Philistia denied that it had ever happened and said that it was just a big lie being spread by the Israelites and other enemies. At any rate, the giant had finally dragged himself up and prepared himself to issue yet another challenge. Even if he wasn't on time for the Israelite sacrifice, still, he did show up and was once again putting the fear of Dagon in them. Roz had once asked Goliath why he challenged Israel first thing in the morning and in the late afternoon. He just laughed and said, "Because that's when the dupes offer sacrifices to their god. I just like to spite them, that's all. Take some of the enjoyment out of their day. Rub it in their faces that their god doesn't seem to be doing them much good." With that, he laughed loudly and took another quaff of wine. Well, today he had missed the sacrifice, but that's okay. There seems to be a pretty good crowd gathered across the way. I don't know what they're doing, but we'll break up their little party, thought Rozid, as he lifted the heavy shield of his master Goliath higher for all of Israel to see. David was appalled at the spectacle he was beholding. Granted, the giant was a dreadful sight, but it was Israel's response, or lack of it, that sickened him. Adding insult to injury was the utter panic that had ensued at the mere sound of the giant's voice. Looking about him, he became indignant and thought, "Surely the king does not know about this. Surely he does not realize what his men are doing." Some of his thoughts must have shown on his astonished face, for one of the younger soldiers, who was on the ground behind the wagon, said, "Have you heard about the great riches the king has offered to anyone who kills him?" "What?" David answered, his eyes opening wide. "Yes, and not only that, the king will give him one of his daughters as a wife, and his whole family will be exempted from paying taxes or from even having to serve in the army." David was stunned. When he found his voice, he said louder than he had meant to, "What did you say? What is going to be done for the man that kills the uncircumcised Philistine and takes away the reproach of the armies of the living God?" What he actually felt like saying was, "Have we sunk so low that we cannot get someone to do the will of God simply because it has to be done? Do you mean to tell me that we have to offer great rewards just to get somebody to do what's right?" All this and more must have been written on David's face, for the soldier answered, "Well, that's what's going to happen to the man that kills him." Suddenly, David felt a strong hand spinning him around. Facing him was the angry countenance of his oldest brother, Eliab. When he spoke, it was through clenched teeth. "What are you doing here? What has happened to those few sheep you're supposed to be taking care of? I know how proud and full of mischief you are. All you've come for is to see the battle." David steadily returned his oldest brother's gaze and quietly said, "And just what have I done this time, Eliab? It seems to me that there is a cause here." Eliab's face darkened in anger and was about to reply, but at that moment, the captain of the unit arrived. He had been some distance away when the giant issued his challenge and had been in no hurry to make his way back to his unit. He now saw Eliab and the young man with him in what seemed to be a pretty heated exchange of words, and he asked what was going on. After the soldier repeated David's words to the captain, he approached David and gave him a long and appraising look. Then he asked him coolly, "And what, young man, would you suggest we do about our dilemma on the other side of the valley?" Without missing a beat, the shepherd boy replied, "Kill him, and with the help of God, that's what I intend to do." The captain raised his eyebrows, looked long and deeply into the young man's face, and said, "Come with me." He started to walk off, then paused, turned back, and asked, "Did someone say something about cheese?" After what seemed an interminable wait, David was ushered into the vast tent of the king. Seated not far from him were several military men of note, as well as the captain of the host. The king glanced up briefly at the boy and continued heatedly to dress down an officer for, what seemed to David, the relatively minor infraction of improperly bowing to a superior. "An uncircumcised Philistine is across the way wreaking havoc on the armies of the living God with nothing more than his mouth? And the king is browbeating a man for failing to properly greet a superior?" the shepherd boy wondered to himself. Saul had the troubled, angry look upon him that David had seen so many times before, and the boy immediately wished he had brought his harp along, that he might ease this fearsome countenance through song. But alas, that was not to be. Finally, looking up at David, the king said with a sarcastic snarl in his voice, "Amittai tells me you seem to think you're the solution to our problem." "Yes, sir, your highness. I believe that the giant will meet his maker this very day, if I may be so bold, sir." An amused look appeared on all faces except for the king's and Abner's, who both studied the young man intently. "Well, well," the king finally said, "I do think we would all be relieved to see that blessed event." At this remark, twitters of laughter came from the gathered men. "My lord, if I may," David replied, slightly raising his voice, "Jehovah God will this day avenge his name in the sight of the Philistines, that all may know that there is a God in heaven who will not be mocked." The laughter was brought to a halt. The king arose from his seat, with all others following suit, and approached the young man. He placed a hand on his shoulder and in a serious tone said, "Son, you are but a youth. That giant has been a man of war from a very young age. How can you possibly stand before him?" "Your Highness, several years ago God delivered into my hand a lion that dared to raise itself up against my father's flock. I slew it, and later a bear as well. That same God who delivered me from the claws of the lion and the paws of the bear will deliver this giant into my hand." This was said with such deep conviction that sober silence was the only response offered. At that moment, a tiny ray of hope began to pierce the gloom that had encased each man's heart for the last 40 days. After looking into each of his military men's solemn faces, the king turned his eyes back to the youth who stood before him and said, "How old are you?"
"I am 17, Your Highness."
The king's eyes never left the eyes of the youth. After a lengthy pause, he quietly said, "Amittai, get my armor." Silence reigned as piece by piece Saul began to place his protective plating upon the much smaller young man. He got no further than the breastplate when the ridiculousness of the sight stopped him from proceeding. David stared up at the king, slowly lifted the large helmet from his head, and quietly said, "Sir, I have never fought in this or any armor, and I haven't proved them. But if you will allow me, sir, I will bring the giant down with this." With that declaration, he slipped from the folds of his garment a sling. The assembled men stared down at the weapon David held, not daring to look at each other nor utter a syllable. "Well," the king said at last, "being a Benjamite, I do know the value of a well-placed rock. All I can say is, the will of God be done this day." He started to turn, stopped, and said, "You are my musician, aren't you?" The young man smiled, bowed, and said, "Yes, Your Highness, I am." Razed spent the afternoon walking softly about the tent and made certain that everyone else did as well. After the challenge of the morning, the giant ate ferociously and went back to the tent to sleep off the final effects of the previous night's revelry. As he lay down on his pallet, he gave firm instruction for Razed to wake him in plenty of time. "I want to give them something to think about while they sacrifice to their god," he snickered, and was fast asleep. 4 hours later, Razed slowly lifted the corner of the tent flap to see if the giant still slept. To his relief, he saw that he had arisen, dressed, and was washing his face. "Well, Razed, fetch my armor. It's time to strike a little more fear into the curs across the way." Razed thanked his gods that the giant seemed to be in a better mood. After fitting into his armor, Goliath had a passing youth fetch more food for him and sent Razed off to see how close the Israelites were to preparing their sacrifice. Razed appeared in 10 minutes and said they were about to start. Goliath leisurely sat back upon the special bench that had been crafted for him and continued to eat the gargantuan snack of beef and bread. He reached for his wine goblet and said, "Well, we won't keep them waiting long." David closely watched the priests as they offered up sacrifice to the God of heaven. It was not his first sacrifice to see, but he was still thoroughly intrigued. Being from Bethlehem, he didn't get to see that many sacrifices, especially when offered up by such important priests as now traveled with the king. Since Samuel's first great rebuke, Saul had never been without a priest to offer the sacrifices, even though he had more than once muttered under his breath, "For all the good it does us." To David, the presence of these godly priests was an added blessing. Why the great God, maker of heaven and earth, would grace his people by so visiting them was simply beyond David's comprehension. He stood that afternoon, feeling the presence, while also feeling words of a new psalm begin to flow into his heart and mind. "Remember all thy offerings, and accept thy burnt sacrifice.
Selah. Some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we will remember the name of the Lord our God. Israel's soldiers that stood about were not nearly as fascinated as the young shepherd. Though they watched the priests, the flames, and the sacrifice, they each in their turn stole glances toward the valley. Save for this morning, every sacrifice had been interrupted by the bellow of the giant. When he hadn't shown this morning, some had hopefully stated that perhaps he had given up, been sent away, or had even died of something. But the giant had come, late though he was, and inflicted his hellish bedlam. Most of the soldiers had heard by now that this young stripling was supposed to somehow go out and fight the giant. They could not fathom this, any more than they could fathom that if he was supposed to fight the giant, what was he doing here? Why stand about like an awestruck kid, staring at the priests and the sacrifice, when in a few moments' time he would more than likely be dead, and take a bunch of them with him? However, there he was, seemingly oblivious to what faced him. If he'd been here all the time we have and heard all we've heard, he'd be acting a little differently, said more than a few of the veterans of the 40-day standoff. Not a one of them had any idea how truly anxious the young man was. I can't let myself go. I've got to keep a hold of myself, he kept repeating to himself from the moment he left the king's tent. To steady himself, he determined to view closely the sacrifice and to pray. He also sang to himself portions of psalms he had written that had meant so much to him. And now shall mine head be lifted up above mine enemies round about me. Therefore will I offer in his tabernacle sacrifices of joy. I will sing, yea, I will sing praises unto the Lord. Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, my strength and my Redeemer. He sang this over and over until there was mixed in with his apprehension a sure knowledge that God would somehow see him through. He stood fascinated with his God and sang this older psalm as well as the new one under his breath, praying all the while. He did this until he began to hear a soldier whispering behind him. The softly spoken words left David's blood cold. Here he comes. Oh God, please help us. Here comes the giant. He's making his way down the slope, muttered the frightened soldier. David forced himself to keep his eyes upon the sacrifice and refused to turn until he began to hear, Send me a man, O Israel, send me a man that I may fight with him. Do we need whole armies to settle this? I will stand for the Philistines, and you choose someone to stand for you, and it will be settled in single combat. If your warrior is able to kill me, then the Philistines will be your slaves. But if I kill him, then Israel must be our slaves. I defy the armies of Israel this day. Send me a man who will fight. Send me a man. As David took a deep breath and began to walk away from the sacrifice, his brother Eliab sidled up next to him and began to speak in low tones. David, look, don't do this. You know mother and father will never recover. You don't have to do it, David. Look, I'm sorry for what I said. You don't have to prove a thing to me or anybody else. I was just hasty, that's all. This whole ordeal has been nerve-wracking, and... David stopped walking, turned to his oldest brother, looked up into his face, and said, Eliab, it's going to be okay. I'm not doing this for you or out of spite to you or anybody else. There truly is a cause here today, much bigger than any of us. It is all about God and His name and His glory. Eliab, what the giant has done, he has not done to us. He's done it to God, and God will be vindicated. Not me or you or Israel or the king. This day, God will be vindicated. Eliab stood still and continued to stare after his brother as David began to jog toward the descent of the valley. The giant finished his speech, gave it one more time for good measure, laughed out loud, turned away, and began to go back up the hill. It was then that he heard the quiet voice of his servant. Master, wait, I think something is happening. The giant turned back, looked across into the camp of Israel, and did notice that for the first time they had not run in fear and confusion. Other than that, he could tell of nothing amiss until a portion of the mass seemed to open up, and what looked to be a young man, yes, a very young man, came trotting from their lines, carrying what looked to be a shepherd's staff, and coming down the slope. The giant was instantly furious, If they think I'm going to accept terms of surrender from a kid and not from one of their captains, they are sadly mistaken, he growled under his breath. Many of the Philistine army had grown bored with the 40-day-long spectacle and had quit coming to what they called the Feast of Shame. Now, word began to spread through the ranks that it looked like something was finally happening with the pathetic wretches across the valley. The Philistines began to gather and almost immediately began to laugh at the sight. Goliath could hear his fellow soldiers chortling on the hill behind him and grew even angrier. He knew they would never laugh at him, not at least where he could hear it, but it infuriated him to even be involved in a laughing matter. Then it grew worse. He began to realize that the youth, smaller and perhaps even younger than his own servant, was not coming to discuss Israel's terms of surrender, but was apparently coming to fight. He could tell it by the look on the boy's face. Though the Philistine laughter had now escalated into guffaws, the Israelites were solemnly quiet. The giant watched as the boy began to lope down the hill to the small brook that lay in the bottom of the valley, stopped on the bank, and seemed to be picking up stones. Some he would toss a little into the air, as if he were getting their feel, and then place them into a shepherd's bag that he wore on his side. He didn't seem in a hurry, and was in fact relaxed in his appearance. Once satisfied with his decisions on which stones to keep, the boy stood, looked up the hill for a long time, and actually smiled at the giant, who was standing about 70 yards away. When Goliath saw this and how young the lad actually was, he was beside himself with fury and screamed, "Am I a dog that you come at me with mere sticks?" He cursed the youth in vile terms and in the names of his gods. "Come here," he shrieked, "and I'll give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field." David lifted his voice and in a loud, resonant tone that none there would ever forget, said, "You come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Almighty Jehovah, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day Jehovah will hand you over to me, and I'll strike you down and cut off your head. Today I will give the carcasses of the entire Philistine army to the birds of the air and the beasts of the earth, and all the world will know that there is a God in Israel. And all gathered here today will know that it is not by sword or spear that the Lord Jehovah saves, for the battle is Jehovah's, and he will give all of you into our hands. I will thank the gods to the end of my days for the words the giant hissed to me after that exchange. Get out of the way, boy, and take that shield with you. I'm not going to need it." I scrambled out of there as fast as possible without appearing to be frightened, which I was, down to my toenails. Of course, Goliath would win. That wasn't even a consideration. But there was something about that red-headed boy, his words, and the look on his face as he ran toward us that gave me pause. Though he'd had the temerity to smile earlier, there was now in his features a ferocity that was bone-chilling. Worst of all, there seemed to be an absolute, utter lack of fear in him. He was almost overwhelming in his absolute conviction that he was indeed going to feed Goliath to the fowls of the air. I ran past Goliath as he lumbered down the hill. His hands were outstretched, and he had not even bothered to unsheath his sword. It was as if he was determined to tear the boy limb from limb with his bare hands. With a quick glance, I saw that the young man was still running hard up the hill and seemed to be preparing a sling as he ran. I continued my ascent, but stopped when I began to hear a faint whooshing sound from behind. 30 yards above me, the Philistine army had now amassed in full, and though some were smiling, not a one of them had continued to laugh. I turned to look back, and I saw that Goliath was about 30 yards below me and moving fast in his rage. The sight of the huge warrior coming toward him in a roaring frenzy seemed not to affect the young man in the least, but rather he was whirling the sling over the top of his head furiously as he ran. I was still shocked that he had not a bit of armor upon him anywhere. He'd dropped his staff at the bottom of the ravine and now had nothing with him at all except a sling and a rock. I realized that Goliath's taunting had finally pushed some poor soul in Israel over the edge. The gods knew what it had almost done to me. The two kept running toward one another, the youth up the hill and Goliath moving down it. The giant was now screaming like an animal, letting loose a horrendous roar from somewhere way down deep within him. He exhibited an anger, a rage that was almost insane. On many an occasion, I have seen men by dozens quail before him with yells that were half that volume. But again, it fazed that youth not in the least. He just kept running. As he did, I was able to distinguish intensity in his eyes, an absolute inferno of indignation. Then it happened. I saw the youth loose the screaming rock and heard two things at once. One was the crack of the rock as it hit the giant's head. The second was the instant sound of silence as Goliath stopped his yelling in mid-sentence. It was instantaneous. The amazing thing was that he had stopped running and didn't keep flying down the hill. He just stopped. He stopped his screaming, running, and all other movement instantly and stood straight up. At that moment, I don't think anyone in the Philistine camp knew exactly what had happened, and I know this is terrible. He was, after all, my master and champion. I would have given anything to see the look on his face at that moment, though in the end, I guess I did. All we could see was the back of the giant as he stood upright, then seemed to weave like a huge cedar in the wind and slowly fall forward flat on his face. There are no words to describe the shock that ran through Philistia in that single moment. All were thoroughly dumbstruck, but I think Israel was too, for not one of them made a sound or moved. Astonishment seemed to fill the valley of Shoko. But the shock was just beginning. The young warrior had stopped to watch the giant fall, then ran the rest of the way to where he lay. He stood there, looking down on him for a moment, then kicked Goliath's unbuckled helmet from off his head. He reached down, took Goliath's sword from his sheath, stepped up onto the back of the giant, raised the sword high over his own head, screamed in triumph, and, to our horror, severed Goliath's head from his body. I feared for a moment that he was going to give him the Samuel Agag treatment, but then he did even worse. He took Goliath's spear, thrust it up into the neck and head, and lifted the grotesque thing high up in the air for all of us to see. That's when I saw the look of astonishment on the face of Goliath. The stone from the sling was deeply embedded into the middle of the giant's forehead. I know it was a terrible thought, but I couldn't help saying to myself, he just thought he had a splitting headache this morning. We stood dreadfully amazed until we began to hear a roar. Israel had finally come alive. I was so thankful that Goliath had ordered me away, as the last thing I wanted was to appear frightened that day to Philistia. As it worked out, I had nothing to fear on that score. Everybody fled. It was as if the red-headed youth had smote us all together at once. We fled the mount with Israel in hot pursuit. I somehow managed to survive the slaughter that followed, but it was only due to my youth and speed. Obviously, I was mortified that we had been so humiliated, but to be honest, I felt relieved to wake up knowing that I was not at the beck and call of Goliath any longer. With my luck, I'll end up being someone else's slave, but who knows? Having served the giant, maybe I can turn it around and become some kind of celebrity. Of course, I'll have to tell how wonderful he was, how kind he really was down deep underneath his brusque exterior. But in my heart, I'll always know that Goliath was a huge bully who deserved everything he got that day, and much, much more. My real regret is that I'd give almost anything to know the young man's name that brought him and all Philistia down. And I wish, oh, how I wish, though I'll have to curse him publicly to the gods in Gath, that I could get to know him personally. For the first time in my life, and granted, it was but for a moment, I wished I had been born an Israeli. King Saul and I led the victorious procession home, and though I was captain of the host in deference to him, I kept my horse back just a little. The rout over the Philistines had been utterly complete, and the sense of accomplishment was a wonderful change. It was fortunate indeed for the heathens that the harp player had killed the giant at the time of the evening sacrifice. Had we more time, God only knows what ruin we could have wreaked upon them. As it was, the Philistine casualties were enormous, while ours were extremely light. The men were very thankful the ordeal was over and were anxious to get to their farms and homes. We did not leave, however, until the army had regathered and all were accounted for. The next morning, the king was in as great a mood as I'd seen him in years, and the men were jubilant. Strangely, the harp-playing boy, well, to give him his due, the giant-killing boy, was not to be found. Until he rejoined us late in the afternoon, both the king and I figured that he had simply gone back home, wherever that was. The next morning, the king was still jubilant as the army began to make its way back to Gibeah. There I would quarter the professional army while the men from the tribes, other than Judah and Benjamin, would return to their various regions. The king and I rode side by side on our horses with the commanding officers right behind us. Behind them rode David, the harp player, and Jonathan, the king's son. In an act of appreciation, which I thought was a bit much, Jonathan had placed his own armor on David and was smiling as grandly as if he had brought down the giant himself. I asked the harp player 3 times last night where he had gone off to during the battle. I just figured that after his lucky shot at the giant, his nerves had given way and he had to find somewhere to get himself together. Well, he, and several others, assured me that he had been in the thick of the rout and had slain numerous other Philistines in the process. I was impressed, as I did not know that a musician could have that kind of fight in him. It was actually kind of refreshing. But still, that did not account for his being gone till the late afternoon of the next day. Had he gone home? Had he passed out somewhere? I was about to leave the lad standing there, since I really didn't care where he'd gone, or where he went next for that matter, when one of the soldiers cleared his throat and asked if he might speak. I looked at him a long time and said, "Yes, you can speak." "David was not here, sir, because after the battle subsided, he took the head of the giant, 2 of the Philistines' horses, and we rode together all night to Jebus, the high city of the Jebus—" "I know where Jebus is," I interrupted. "Yes, sir. Well, David took the head of the giant, it was still on Goliath's spear, sir, and thrust it into the ground outside the front gate before daylight. After the sun came up, he began to yell up to the watchmen on the walls." I waited for the soldier to continue, but he just stared at me. Finally, I said, "Well, what did he yell up to the people on the wall?" He cleared his throat again and said, "Well, sir, what he said was, 'Here is a present for you. This will have to do for now, until I bring you another one, a much better one.' Then he spun away on his horse and we rode directly back here, sir." I stared at the harp player. He stared back at me, and nothing further was said. Then I turned and left. News of the victory had apparently filled the country. Before long, as our army came down toward the area of Hebron, we began to hear the sounds of women singing and children yelling. No doubt the women were going to do what thankful women did and bolster the spirits of the men who had hazarded their lives for them and for their children. As we drew closer, we could make out sounds of the ringing tambourines and see the whirling dances of the younger girls. Saul was laughing and enjoying the moment immensely. No doubt he was thinking of the sons of Belial and their mocking at his coronation so many years before. But now all Israel could not help but recognize his greatness and his accomplishments as their king. In moments like these, Samuel's dire threats and anger over being rejected as Israel's leader faded deep into oblivion next to the king's resounding successes. We were close enough now to make out some of the words that the women were singing, but not all. We knew for sure that it was a joyous refrain and that Saul's name was in it. Again, he was extremely pleased, and when he finally caught the first words of what was being said, he beamed in delight. "Saul has slain his thousands." Then, just as quickly, it looked as if he had received an arrow in his back. His face fell, the color drained white, as we all made out the second part of the song. "And David has slain his 10,000. This, the women of Israel kept singing over and over and over. When the king could finally speak, he croaked, "They ascribe unto me thousands, but unto him 10,000. What more can they give him but the kingdom?" We rode along in silence as the sounds of the singing women faded in our ears. The king was back to brooding now, and I could see that the black dog of his soul had returned to sit on the porch of his brow. By and by, he said, "Abner, tell me, whose son is this youth?" To which I said, "As your soul lives, O king, I cannot tell." Presently the king halted the procession, turned his horse, and rode back into the lines in between his captains and between Jonathan and the harp player. He looked long and hard into the face of David and said, "Whose son are you, young man?" David answered, "I am the son of your servant, Jesse the Bethlehemite." Saul said nothing. Then he turned his horse roughly around, scooting both Jonathan and David's out of his way, and returned to the head of the procession. We resumed our trek in silence. I felt the king's sullen stillness a long while before finally leaning toward him in my saddle and softly saying, "Your Majesty, the song we heard was, for the most part, sung by women of Judah. It is only natural for them to be proud of one of their own, and to indiscreetly go too far in their praise of him. But you mustn't think that..." The king never looked in my direction, but rather he cut me off with a sharp wave of his hand. I sat upright in my saddle, continued to ride on the now grim journey, and kept my eyes straight ahead. After several minutes, I heard the king of Israel mutter, "Well, Samuel, I've found my neighbor."